after a 2-hour game.
I don't have like ice baths and shit.
No.
You know, I'm in the daggone cage putting duct tape on my daggone ankles and feet, and you know, it's just, it's excruciating. And I'm hoping to get, you know, in the Pacific Ocean because it was cold. So I was hoping to get in that water so my body would get frozen. So that would also help with, it was actually numb. It actually numbed my feet.
Fuck yeah. I mean, you're still on a fucking, a reserve salary.
Exactly.
You're not even getting a full SEAL salary.
No, man. So this ain't like Kobe Bryant no. shit, man. This is like, you know, I'm sitting here thinking,
this
man.
This is caveman.
Yeah, this is straight up barbaric. This is caveman. Savage. Yeah. Like, next level Garanimal shit.
I mean, what's the difference in pay? Like, how much were you making and how much were you hoping to get just by running on broken legs?
So basically, I was in E5, I believe. I was in E4. So I was in E4 and I was probably bringing home, going through Buds, about $2,200 a month.
And then if you got through Buds, what was your payday?
I was going to get, I was part of the STAR program. So I was going to go from E4 to E5, which jumped my pay up. I was going to get dive pay and jump pay and demo pay. So that was going to jack my pay up from about $2,200 a month to damn near $4,500, you know, double my pay.
Which is great, but it's not Kobe Bryant game pay.
No, not at all, man. And, you know, and plus going through Buds, Your legs, that's almost 100% of what you're doing.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was very different. And there was no, you know, really days off.
Yeah, man. You know, that's what I'm saying, man. When I hear your story, that's all I can think about is who are the people out there going through stuff you just can't even imagine? You know what I mean? And like that and fighting for it. You know, it's actually life affirming to hear you, all that you had to go through and you achieved and you got through it. It's like, That's why I'm motivated by your story, and I think a lot of people are, because it shows you that it's possible to go through shit you can't even imagine.
Well, what's funny is some of the hardest people on the planet Earth, you'll never hear about.
No.
So we idolize these sport figures.
Yeah.
You know, because they have a broken toenail, or they have plantar fasciitis. You know, oh my yeah. God, you know, like Peyton Manning, he has plantar fasciitis. I know a million ultra runners who every day run with plantar fasciitis.
Right.
So it's just how we, you know, we idolize these people and just these old school knuckle draggers, these everyday men and women who are getting after it, who are hard as shit. And it's like, hey, whatever, man, just get up and do something that sucks every day. They don't care.
No, amazing. Well, let's do a couple behind the scenes on the SEALs that we didn't, you know, we're going to get into more SEAL stuff as you go. But, you know, with your deployments, but, some of the guys that aren't in the deployments either that we want to highlight, I think there was Drew Sheets and we wanted to give some backstory, as well to some other guys.
So with Drew Sheets was in my third Hell Week and he was my Bill Brown. So Bill Brown was in my second Hell Week. Drew Sheets was in my third Hell Week and he was my pillar beside me. He was the guy that was like, look, so the front of the boat is extremely heavy.
He was Bill Brown for your third Hell Week.
Exactly. He was my Bill Brown for my third Hell Week. And he was the guy, I was number one guy. The number one position on the boat is the front of the boat is heavy as shit. Number two is about the second heaviest spot, which is also the front of the boat. And basically we both got out of Hell Week and it was like what? It was, we got out Thursday morning and we were both on crutches. And we both have broken legs. But the thing with Drew Sheets is that Drew couldn't continue on. This was Drew's first class. Mm. This was my third class. So Drew actually got rolled back, I think, to class either 236 or 237. And Drew couldn't believe that I was going on because we both had the same amount. You know, we had a high number of breaks in our shins. And I was like, hey, I gotta keep on going, dude. So that's Drew Sheets. We had Bill Brown from my second Hell Week. And a great story about Bill Brown was in his first class, he was in dive phase and Bill got beat a lot. Push ups, sit ups, stuff like that. You know, the instructors just didn't like Bill Brown.
Yeah.
So there was one time that Bill got in trouble or they didn't like him for whatever reason and they made him do 8-count bodybuilders and they forgot about him. And he was in the back by second phase. In a location where you could easily get, you know, forgotten about. And Bill was back there for a few hours doing 8-count bodybuilders. And the class went to chow. The class came back. The class did some stuff. And like, hey, do a muster. A muster's like, hey, you know, like, basically like a head count.
Mm.
So they did a muster and they couldn't find Bill Brown. And the instructor remembered, oh my God, I had him do 8-count bodybuilders. So he was expecting to see Bill Brown just kind of sitting back there chilling out. He went back there hours later and Freak Brown is still busting out 8-count bodybuilders, man. Hours later, Nobody watching them, totally accountable. So that was a great story about Bill Brown. And you know about Kenny Bigby, man. So we interviewed all these guys and you can share some stories about Kenny Bigby. And I have some also.
Yeah. I think the story that I like the best is, so Kenny Bigby, he was a competitive martial artist. His dad had a dojo, also in Indianapolis, correct?
Yeah. We both actually, I went to North Central for about half the year, maybe a little bit less. Kenny Bigby went to North Central 2 years after I did.
And he's like worshiping Bruce Lee and all that. And he was a great martial artist. And then he ends up, also was a great dancer. I mean, he was just a great athlete. And, the story I remember him telling us was that he basically had maybe 100 or 200 bucks to his name and he got in a van with a bunch of guys
yep.
And they came out to California to try to make it in, you know, music videos and in Hollywood doing the dancing thing. And he was getting by, he was literally homeless in LA, getting by doing dance shows on the Venice Boardwalk. You know, those guys that do the kind of flip shows and the hip hop breakdancing shows. And he was living that way. And he ended up making, you know, getting some money together, getting some jobs and getting a place. But I just found it so fascinating that he was out there for the better part of a year and then ends up joining up in the Navy. I just found it fascinating. Like you just never, that's another one. You just never know who you're interacting with, who you're seeing and the capacity that these guys have. And I just love Kenny's story about that. And he's just fucking hilarious.
Oh man, Kenny was a funny dude. Oh, he is a funny guy. And there was one time going through Bud's, I think it was, it was in my second hell week. I mean, it was like freezing outside and the instructor's like, hey, Kenny, backspin.
Mm.
Hey, do the backspin. So this guy is on the sand in the beach doing the backspin breakdancing. It was hilarious, man. He's busted out electric boogaloo type shit.
I mean, it's amazing, and I loved him telling the story about David Goggins is back on the log. I mean, I wish we could have bottled that for this, man.
It was great, man. Yeah, I should have brought Kenny in here, man, put him on the mic, because he tells it better than anybody, man.
No one can tell that story like him.
No, not like Kenny. And he has that crazy voice.
Yeah, he does all the voices. So shout out Big B.
Yes, sir.
All right, cool. So, now we're getting ready to get into chapter 6 and we're going to switch gears. I mean, the SEALs are always still in it and you'll be in it all the way through, but now we switch gears a little bit.
Now we can't forget about the challenge 5 here for these folks.
Oh, sorry about that.
All good.
Challenge 5. It's time to visualize. Again, the average person thinks 2,000 to 3,000 thoughts per hour. Rather than focusing on bullshit you cannot change, imagine visualizing the things you can. Choose any obstacle in your way or set a new goal and visualize overcoming or achieving it. Before I engage in any challenging activity, I start by painting a picture of what my success looks and feels like. I'll think about it every day, and that feeling propels me forward when I'm training, competing, or taking on any task I choose. But visualization isn't simply about daydreaming of some trophy ceremony, real or metaphorical. You must also visualize the challenges that are likely to arise and determine how you will attack those problems when they do. That way you can be as prepared as possible on the journey. When I show up for a foot race now, I drive the entire course first, visualizing success but also potential challenges, which helps me control my thought process. You can't prepare for everything, but if you engage in strategic visualization ahead of time, you'll be as prepared as you possibly can be. That also means being prepared to answer the simple questions. Why are you doing this? What is driving you toward this achievement? Where does the darkness you're using as fuel come from? What has calloused your mind? You'll need to have those answers at your fingertips when you hit a wall of pain and doubt. To push through, you'll need to channel your darkness, feed off it, and lean on your calloused mind. Remember, visualization will never compensate for work undone. You cannot visualize lies. All the strategies I employ to answer the simple questions and win the mind game are only effective because I put in work. It's a lot more than mind over matter. It takes relentless self-discipline to schedule suffering into your day, every day. But if you do, you'll find that at the other end of that suffering is a whole other life just waiting for you. This challenge doesn't have to be physical. And victory doesn't always mean you came in first place. It can mean you finally overcome a lifelong fear or any other obstacle that made you surrender in the past. Whatever it is, tell the world your story about how you created your hashtag armored mind and where it's taken you. I always find this interesting because I mentioned it before, but like, I've been in these circuit training, and in circuit training, they like to push you. You want to get into the red for periods and get back into the orange and get into the red, you know, heart rate zones. And, I'm able to do it because I visualize you, but when I'm on running by myself and I'm in pain, it's so hard to actually think of the simple answers to the questions. It's actually really hard to do it because to take that extra energy that it takes to think intellectual thoughts and that kind of problem solving,
right?
It's super hard. Like, and so what's a good shortcut to making the, make sure those answers, I mean, do you have to like really focus on them before you start the run, or how do you make sure they're at the forefront of your mind? Cause it's more complex than just remembering them.
It's huge. So one thing I started doing is I started realizing that when you're trying to go back through all these different tools that you have, your mind starts to become kind of spastic. Like you said, for instance, you were running some, you know, like your brain gets out of control, starts losing control of what's going on.
Yeah.
You have to learn, it's called the 1 second decision. And it's something that I have taken on board. It's something that I invented for myself because I would spaz out. And like, for instance, in Navy SEAL training, when they put your ass in that cold water after the first hour of breakout, they put you in there and that first wave of, you know, wave from the ocean goes over your head and you're frozen and you start to spaz out. So all that visualization, all that self-talk, all those nice tools that we have, they're out the door. You have to kind of calm your mind down that 1 second versus panicking and spazzing out. Take time to literally be patient, calm down, and get trained. Just like regain your thought process.
How do you do that when you're in the midst of a run, like you're running in the red?
You have to almost, you have to slow your heart rate down.
Okay.
So when you're going fast, going too fast actually kind of makes you even more spazzed out.
Okay.
So you have to slow down your tempo, and in slowing down your tempo, it relaxes your mind.
So it's okay to slow down the tempo, because then if you can start to control your mind, then when you speed back up, you'll be in better control.
Exactly. So when the heart rate goes up, everything starts to speed up. You have to try to slow your heart rate down in that moment, whether it's slowing down running or even slowing down your thought process. If you have a really fast thought process, that will speed your heart rate up because it makes your adrenaline flow through your body. So you got to try to calm all that down in that 1 second when your mind's going fast, your body's going fast, your heart rate's up high. Calm it down and try to calm down your thoughts and think logically versus in that panic mode.
Gotcha. And I love how you describe visualization, because a lot of people think athletes or anyone who employs visualization like this, strategic visualization, usually it's focused on just the game itself and visualizing success afterwards. No one really talks about the steps like you do here, visualizing each step of the process and all the problems. So it's not just visualizing success and projecting some success you're trying to manifest. It's actually visualizing the actual problems, doing research on the problems so that you can then be prepared for them.
That's right. So you'll hear here pretty soon about me doing these different races. And without visualizing the issues that are going to come up, there's going to be issues. Like whenever you run as far as I run, or, you know, whatever I do, there's going to be issues that come up. So you have to visualize, okay, at about mile 24, 25, 35, 45, this and this and this, you know, this might happen. And if you don't account for the might happen, when it does happen, you're not going to know what to do.
Chapter 6. It's not about a trophy. Everything about the race was going better than I could have hoped. There were enough clouds in the sky to blunt the heat of the sun. My rhythm was as steady as the mellow tide that sloshed against the hulls of sailboats docked in the nearby San Diego marina. And though my legs felt heavy, that was to be expected, considering my tapering plan the night before. Besides, they seemed to be loosening up as I rounded a bend to complete my ninth lap, my ninth mile, just an hour and change into a 24-hour race. That's when I saw John Metz, race director of the San Diego One Day, eyeballing me at the start-finish line. He was holding up his whiteboard to inform each competitor of their time and position in the overall field. I was in fifth place, which evidently confused him. I offered a crisp nod to reassure him that I knew what I was doing, that I was right where I was supposed to be. He saw through that shit. Metz was a veteran, always polite and soft-spoken. It didn't look like there was much that could faze him, but he was also a seasoned ultramarathoner, with 3 50-mile races in his saddlebag. He'd either reached or topped 100 miles 7 times, and he'd achieved his personal best of 144 miles in 24 hours when he was 50 years old, which is why it meant something to me that he looked concerned. I checked my watch, synced to a heart rate monitor I wore around my chest. My pulse straddled my magic number line, 145. A few days earlier, I'd run into my old buds instructor, SBG, at Naval Special Warfare Command. Most SEALs do rotations as instructors between deployments, and SBG and I worked together. When I told him about the San Diego One Day, he insisted I wear a heart rate monitor to pace myself. SBG was a big geek when it came to performance and recovery, and I watched as he scratched out a few formulas, then turned to me and said, "Keep your pulse steady between 140 and 145, and you'll be golden." The next day, he handed me a heart rate monitor as a race day gift. If you set out to mark a course that could crack open a Navy SEAL like a walnut, chew him up and spit him the fuck out, San Diego's hospitality point would not make the cut. We're talking about terrain so vanilla, it's downright serene. Tourists descend year-round for views of San Diego's stunning marina, which spills into Mission Bay. The road is almost entirely smooth asphalt and perfectly flat, save a brief 7-foot incline with the pitch of a standard suburban driveway. There are manicured lawns, palm trees, and shade trees. Hospitality Point is so inviting that disabled and convalescing folks head there with their walkers for an afternoon's rehab stroll all the time. But the day after John Metz chalked his easy 1-mile course, it became the scene of my total destruction. I should have known that a breakdown was coming. By the time I started running at 10 a.m. on November 12, 2005, I hadn't run more than a mile in 6 months. But I looked like I was fit, because I'd never stopped hitting the gym. While I was stationed in Iraq, on my second deployment with SEAL Team 5 earlier that year, I'd gotten back into serious powerlifting, and my only dose of cardio was 20 minutes on the elliptical once a week. The point is, my cardiovascular fitness was an absolute joke, and still I thought it was a brilliant idea to try and run 100 miles in 24 hours. Okay, it was always a fucked up idea, but I considered it doable because 100 miles in 24 hours demands a pace of just under 15 minutes a mile. If it came to it, I figured I could walk that fast. Only, I didn't walk. When that horn sounded at the start of the race, I took off hot and zoomed to the front of the pack. Exactly the right move if your race day goal is to blow the fuck up. Also, I didn't exactly come in well rested. The night before the race, I passed by the SEAL Team 5 gym on my way off base after work, and peeked in like I always did, just to see who was getting after it. SBG was inside warming up, and called out, "Goggins," he said, "let's jack some fucking steel." I laughed. He stared me down. "You know, Goggins," he said, stepping closer, "when the Vikings were getting ready to raid a fucking village, and they were camped out in the fucking woods in their goddamn tents made out of fucking deer hides and shit, sitting around a campfire, do you think they said, 'Hey, let's have some herbal fucking tea and call it an early night'? Or were they more like, 'Fuck that. We're going to drink some vodka made out of some mushrooms and get all drunked up, so the next morning when they were all hungover and pissed off, they would be in the ideal mood to slaughter the shit out of some people?" SBG could be a funny motherfucker when he wanted to be, and he could see me wavering, considering my options. On the one hand, that man would always be my buds instructor, and he was one of the few instructors who was still hard, putting out, and living the SEAL ethos every day. I'll always want to impress him. Jacking weights the night before my first 100-mile race would definitely impress that masochistic motherfucker. Plus, his logic made some fucked-up sense to me. I needed to get my mind ready to go to war, and lifting heavy would be my way of saying, bring on all your pain and misery. I'm ready to go. But honestly, who does that before running 100 fucking miles? I shook my head in disbelief, threw my bag to the ground, and started racking weights. With heavy metal blaring from the speakers, two knuckle-draggers came together to put the fuck out. Most of our work focused on the legs, including long sets of squats and deadlifts at 315 pounds. In between, we bench-pressed 225. This was a real-deal powerlifting session, and afterwards we sat on that bench next to one another and watched our quads and hamstrings quiver. It was fucking funny, until it wasn't. Ultra running has gone at least somewhat mainstream since then, but in 2005, most ultra races, especially the San Diego One Day, were pretty obscure, and it was all new to me. When the majority of people think of ultras, they picture trail runs through remote wilderness and don't often imagine circuit races. But there were some serious runners in the field at the San Diego One Day. This was the American National 24-Hour Championship, and athletes descended from all over the country hoping for a trophy, a place on the podium, and the modest winner-take-all cash prize of $2,000. No, this was not a gilded event, basking in corporate sponsorship, but it was the site for a team comp between the U.S. Ultra Distance National Team and a team from Japan. Each side fielded teams of four men and four women, who each ran for 24 hours. One of the top individual athletes in the field was also from Japan. Her name was Miss Inagaki, and early on she and I kept pace. SPG turned up to cheer me on that morning with his wife and two-year-old son. They huddled up on the sidelines with my new wife, Kate, who I'd married a few months before, a little over 2 years after my second divorce from Pam was finalized. When they saw me, they couldn't help but double over in laughter. Not just because SBG was still beat up from our workout the night before, and here I was trying to run 100 miles, but because of how out of place I looked. When I spoke to SBG about it not long ago, the scene still made him laugh. "So, ultramarathoners are a little weird, right?" SBG said. And that morning it was like there were all these skinny-ass college professor-looking, fucking granola-eating weirdos, and then there is this one big black dude who looks like a fucking linebacker from the Raiders, running around this track, jacked the fuck up, with no shirt on, and I'm thinking of that song we had in kindergarten. One of these things is not like the other. That is a song going through my head when I saw this fucking NFL linebacker running around this damn track with all these skinny little nerds. I mean, they were some hard motherfuckers, those runners. I am not taking that away from them. But they were all super clinical about nutrition and shit. And you just put a pair of shoes on and said, let's go. He's not wrong. I didn't put much thought into my race plan at all. I hatched it at Walmart the night before, where I bought a fold-out lawn chair for Kate and me to use during the race, and my fuel for the entire day. One box of Ritz crackers and 2 4-packs of Myoplex. I didn't drink much water. I didn't even consider my electrolyte or potassium levels, or eat any fresh fruit. SBG brought me a pack of Hostess chocolate donuts when he showed up, and I gobbled those in a few seconds. I mean, I was winging it for real. Yet, at mile 15, I was still in fifth place, still keeping pace with Miss Inagaki, while Metz was getting more and more nervous. He ran up to me and tagged along. "You should slow down, David," he said. "Pace yourself a bit more." I shrugged. "I got this." It's true that I felt okay in that moment, but my bravado was also a defense mechanism. I knew if I were to start planning my race at that point, the bigness of it would become too much to comprehend. It would feel like I was supposed to run the length of the damn sky. It would feel impossible. In my mind, strategy was the enemy of the moment, which is where I needed to be. Translation, when it came to ultras, I was green as fuck. Metz didn't press me, but he kept a close watch. I finished mile 25 at about the 4-hour mark, and I was still in fifth place, still running with my new Japanese friend. SBG was long gone, and Kate was my only support crew. I'd see her every mile, posted up in that lawn chair, offering a sip of Myoplex and an encouraging smile. I'd run a marathon only once before, while I was stationed in Guam. It was unofficial, and I ran it with a fellow SEAL on a course we made up on the spot. But back then, I was in excellent cardiovascular shape. Now, here I was bearing down on 26.2 miles for just the second time in my entire life, this time without training. And once I got there, I realized that I'd run beyond known territory. I had 20 more hours and nearly 3 more marathons to go. Those were incomprehensible metrics, with no traditional milestone in between to focus on. I was running across the sky. That's when I started thinking that this could end badly. Metz didn't stop trying to help. Each mile, he'd run alongside and check on me. And me being who I am, I told him that I had everything under control and had it all figured out, which was true. I figured out that John Metz knew what the fuck he was talking about. Oh yes, the pain was becoming real. My quads throbbed, my feet were chafed and bleeding, and that simple question was once again bubbling up in my frontal lobe. Why? Why run 100 fucking miles without training? Why was I doing this to myself? Fair questions, especially since I hadn't even heard of the San Diego One Day until 3 days before race day. But this time my answer was different. I wasn't on Hospitality Point to deal with my own demons or to prove anything at all. I came with a purpose bigger than David Goggins. This fight was about my once and future fallen teammates and the families they leave behind when shit goes wrong. Or at least that's what I told myself at mile 27. I had gotten the news about Operation Red Wings, a doomed operation in the remote mountains of Afghanistan, on my last day of U.S. Army Freefall School in Yuma, Arizona, in June. Operation Red Wings was a 4-man reconnaissance mission tasked with gathering intelligence on a growing pro-Taliban force in a region called Satalo-Sar. If successful, what they learned would help define strategy for a larger offensive in the coming weeks. I knew all 4 guys. Danny Dietz was in Bud's class 231 with me. He got injured and rolled just like I did. Michael Murphy, the OIC of the mission, was with me in class 235 before he got rolled. Matthew Axelson was in my Huya class when I graduated. More on the Huya class tradition in a moment. And Marcus Luttrell was one of the first people I met on my original lap through Bud's. Before training begins, each incoming Bud's class throws a party. And the guys from previous classes, who are still in Bud's training, are always invited. The idea is to juice as much information from brown shirts as possible, because you never know what might help get you through a crucial evolution that could make all the difference between graduation and failure. Marcus was 6'4", 225 pounds, and he stuck out in that crowd like I did. I was a bigger guy too, back up to 210 by then, and he sought me out. In some ways, we were an odd pair. He was a hard-ass axe handle from the Texas rangeland, and I was a self-made masochist from the Indiana cornfields. But he'd heard I was a good runner, and running was his main weakness. "Goggins, do you have any tips for me?" he asked. "Because I can't run for shit." I knew Marcus was a badass, but his humility made him real. When he graduated a few days later, we were his Huya class, which meant we were the first people they were allowed to order around. They embraced that SEAL tradition and told us to go get wet and sandy. It was a SEAL's rite of passage and an honor to share that with him. After that, I didn't see him for a long time. I thought I ran into him again when I was about to graduate with class 235, but it was his twin brother, Morgan Luttrell, who was part of my Huya class, class 237, along with Matthew Axelson. We could have ordered up some poetic justice, but after we graduated, instead of telling their class to go get wet and sandy, we put ourselves in the surf, in our dress whites. I had something to do with that. In the Navy SEALs, you're either deployed and operating in the field, instructing other SEALs, or in school yourself, learning or perfecting skills. We cycle through more military schools than most because we are trained to do it all. But when I went through BUDS, we didn't learn to free fall. We jumped by static lines, which deployed our chutes automatically. Back then, you had to be chosen to attend U.S. Army free fall school. After my second platoon, I was picked up for Green Team, which is one of the training phases to get accepted into the Navy Special Warfare Development Group, DEVGRU, an elite unit within the SEALs. That required me to get free fall qualified. It also required that I face my fear of heights in the most confrontational way possible. We started off in the classrooms and wind tunnels of Fort Bragg, North Carolina, which is where I reconnected with Morgan in 2005. Floating on a bed of compressed air in a 15-foot-high wind tunnel, we learned correct body position, how to shift left and right, and push forward and back. It takes very small movements with your palm to move, and it's easy to start spinning out of control, which is never good. Not everyone could master those subtleties, but those of us who could left Fort Bragg after that first week of training and headed to an airstrip in the cactus fields of Yuma to start jumping for real. Morgan and I trained and hung out together for 4 weeks in the 127-degree desert heat of summer. We did dozens of jumps out of C-130 transport jets from altitudes ranging from 12,500 to 19,000 feet. And there is no rush like the surge of adrenaline and paranoia that comes with plummeting to Earth from high altitude at terminal velocity. Each time we jumped, I couldn't help but think of Scott Guerin, the pararescueman who survived a botched jump from high altitude and inspired me on this path when I met him as a high school student. He was a constant presence for me in that desert, and a cautionary tale, proof that something can go horribly wrong on any given jump. When I jumped out of an airplane for the first time from high altitude, all I felt was extreme fear, and I couldn't pry my eyes from my altimeter. I wasn't able to embrace the jump because fear had clogged my mind. All I could think about was whether or not my canopy would open. I was missing the unbelievable thrill ride of the free fall, the beauty of the mountains painted against the horizon, and the wide open sky. But as I became conditioned to the risk, my tolerance for that same fear increased. It was always there, but I was used to the discomfort, and before long I was able to handle multiple tasks on a jump and appreciate the moment too. 7 years earlier, I had been rooting around fast food kitchens and open dumpsters zapping vermin. Now I was fucking flying. The final task in Yuma was a midnight jump in full kit. We were weighed down with a 50-pound rucksack, strapped with a rifle and an oxygen mask for the free fall. We were also equipped with chem lights, which were a necessity because when the back ramp of the C-130 opened up, it was pitch black. We couldn't see any damn thing, but still we leapt into that moonless sky, 8 of us in a line, one after another. We were supposed to form an arrow, and as I maneuvered through the real-world wind tunnel to take my place in the grand design, all I could see were swerving lights streaking like comets in an inkwell sky. My goggles fogged up as the wind ripped through me. We fell for a full minute, and when we deployed our chutes at around 4,000 feet, the overpowering sound went from full tornado to eerie silence. It was so quiet I could hear my heart beat through my chest. It was fucking bliss. And when we all landed safely, we were free fall qualified. We had no idea that at that moment, in the mountains of Afghanistan, Marcus and his team were locked into an all-out battle for their lives, at the center of what would become the worst incident in SEAL history. One of the best things about Yuma is that you have horrible cell service. I'm not big on texting or talking on the phone, so this gave me 4 weeks of peace. When you graduate any military school, the last thing you do is clean all the areas your class used until it's like you were never there. My cleaning detail was in charge of the bathrooms, which happened to be one of the only places in Yuma that has cell service. And as soon as I walked in, I could hear my phone blow up. Text messages about Operation Red Wings going bad flooded in. And as I read them, my soul broke. Morgan hadn't heard anything about it yet, so I walked outside, found him, and told him the news. I had to. Marcus and his crew were all MIA and presumed KIA. He nodded, considered it for a second, and said, "My brother's not dead." Morgan is 1 minute older than Marcus. They were inseparable as kids, and the first time they'd ever been apart for longer than a day was when Marcus joined the Navy. Morgan opted for college before joining up, and during Marcus's hell week, he tried to stay up the whole time in solidarity. He wanted and needed to share that feeling, but there is no such thing as a hell week simulation. You have to go through it to know it. And those that survive are forever changed. In fact, the period after Marcus survived Hell Week and before Morgan became a SEAL himself was the only time there was any emotional distance between the brothers, which speaks to the power of those 130 hours and their emotional toll. Once Morgan went through it for real, everything was right again. They each have half a trident tattooed on their back. The picture is only complete when they stand side by side. Morgan took off immediately to drive to San Diego and figure out what the hell was going on. He still hadn't heard anything about the operation directly, but once he reached civilization and his service hit, a tide of messages flooded his phone too. He floored his rental car to 120 miles per hour and zoomed directly to the base in Coronado. Morgan knew all the guys in his brother's unit well. Axelson was his classmate and buds, and as facts trickled in, it was obvious to most that his brother wouldn't be found alive. I thought he was gone too, but you know what they say about twins. I knew my brother was out there alive, Morgan told me when we connected again in April 2018. I said that the whole time. I'd called Morgan to talk about old times and asked him about the hardest week in his life. From San Diego, he flew out to his family's ranch in Huntsville, Texas, where they were getting updates twice a day. Dozens of fellow SEALs turned up to show support, Morgan said, and for 5 long days, he and his family cried themselves to sleep at night. To them, it was torture knowing that Marcus might be alive and alone in hostile territory. When officials from the Pentagon arrived, Morgan made himself clear as cut glass. Marcus may be hurt and fucked up, but he's alive, and either you go out there and find him, or I will. Operation Red Wings went horribly wrong because there were many more pro-Taliban Hajis active in those mountains than had been expected. And once Marcus and his team were discovered by villagers there, it was 4 guys against a well-armed militia of somewhere between 30 and 200 men. Reports on the size of the pro-Taliban force vary. Our guys took RPG and machine gun fire and fought hard. 4 SEALs can put on a hell of a show. Each one of us can usually do as much damage as 5 regular troops, and they made their presence felt. The battle played out along a ridgeline above 9,000 feet in elevation, where they had communication troubles. When they finally broke through and the situation was made plain to their commanding officer back at Special Operations Headquarters, a quick reaction force of Navy SEALs, Marines, and aviators from 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment was assembled, but they were delayed for hours because of lack of transport capacity. One thing about the SEAL teams is we don't have our own transport. In Afghanistan, we hitch rides with the Army, and that delayed relief. They eventually loaded up into 2 Chinook transport choppers and 4 attack helicopters, 2 Blackhawks and 2 Apaches, and took off for Satalo Sar. The Chinooks took the lead, and as they closed in on the ridge, they were hit by small arms fire. Despite the onslaught, the first Chinook hovered, attempting to unload 8 Navy SEALs on a mountaintop, but they made a fat target, lingered too long, and were hit with a rocket-propelled grenade. The bird spun, crashed into the mountain, and exploded. Everyone aboard was killed. The remaining choppers bailed out, and by the time they could return with ground assets, everyone who was left behind, including Marcus's 3 teammates at Operation Red Wings, was found dead. Everyone, that is, except for Marcus. Marcus was hit multiple times by enemy fire and went missing for 5 days. He was saved by Afghan villagers who nursed and sheltered him and was finally found alive by U.S. troops on July 3, 2005, when he became the lone survivor of a mission that took the lives of 19 Special Operations warriors, including 11 Navy SEALs. No doubt you've heard this story before. Marcus wrote a best-selling book about it, Lone Survivor, which became a hit movie starring Mark Wahlberg. But in 2005, that was all years away, and in the aftermath of the worst battlefield loss ever to hit the SEALs, I was looking for a way to contribute to the families of the men who were killed. It's not like bills stop rolling in after a tragedy like that. There were wives and kids out there with basic needs to fulfill, and eventually they'd need their college educations covered too. I wanted to help in any way I could. A few weeks before all of this, I'd spent an evening Googling around for the world's toughest foot races, and landed on a race called Badwater 135. I'd never even heard of ultramarathons before, and Badwater was an ultramarathoner's ultramarathon. It started below sea level in Death Valley and finished at the end of the road at Mount Whitney Portal, a trailhead located at 8,374 feet. Oh, and the race takes place in late July, when Death Valley isn't just the lowest place on Earth, it's also the hottest. Seeing images from that race materialize on my monitor terrified and thrilled me. The terrain looked all kinds of harsh. and the expressions on tortured runners' faces reminded me of the kind of thing I saw in Hell Week. Until then, I'd always considered the marathon to be the pinnacle of endurance racing, and now I was seeing there were several levels beyond it. I filed the information away and figured I'd come back to it someday. Then Operation Red Wings happened, and I vowed to run Badwater 135 to raise money for the Special Operations Warrior Foundation, a nonprofit founded as a battlefield promise in 1980, when 8 Special Operations Warriors died in a helicopter crash during the famous hostage rescue operation in Iran and left 17 children behind. The surviving servicemen promised to make sure each one of those kids had the money to go to college. Their work continues. Within 30 days of a fatality, like those that occurred during Operation Red Wings, the Foundation's hardworking staff reach out to surviving family members. "We are the interfering aunt," said Executive Director Edie Rosenthal. "We become a part of our students' lives. They pay for preschool and private tutoring during grade school. They arrange college visits and host peer support groups. They help with applications, buy books, laptop computers, and printers, and cover tuition at whichever school one of their students manages to gain acceptance, not to mention room and board. They also send students to vocational schools. It's all up to the kids. As I write this, the Foundation has 1,280 kids in their program. They are an amazing organization, and with them in mind, I called Chris Kossman, race director of Badwater 135, at 7 a.m. in mid-November 2005. I tried to introduce myself, but he cut me off sharp. "Do you know what time it is?" he snapped. I took the phone away from my ear and stared at it for a second. In those days, by 7 a.m. on a typical weekday, I'd have already rocked a 2-hour gym workout and was ready for a day's work. This dude was half asleep. "Roger that," I said. "I'll call you back at 0900. My second call didn't go much better, but at least he knew who I was. SBG and I had already discussed Badwater, and he emailed Kossman a letter of recommendation. SBG has raced triathlons, captained a team through the Eco Challenge, and watched several Olympic qualifiers attempt BUDS. In his email to Kossman, he wrote that I was the best endurance athlete with the greatest mental toughness he'd ever seen. To put me, a kid who came from nothing, at the top of his list meant the world to me, and still does. It didn't mean shit to Chris Kossman. He was the definition of unimpressed. The kind of unimpressed that can only come from real-world experience. When he was 20 years old, he'd competed in the Race Across America bicycle race. And before taking over as Badwater race director, he'd run 3 100-mile races in winter in Alaska and completed a triple Ironman triathlon, which ends with a 78-mile run. Along the way, he'd seen dozens of supposedly great athletes crumble beneath the anvil of ultra. Weekend warriors sign up for and complete marathons after a few months training all the time. But the gap between marathon running and becoming an ultra athlete is much wider, and Badwater was the absolute apex of the ultra universe. In 2005, there were approximately 22 100-mile races held in the United States, and none had the combination of the elevation gain and unforgiving heat that Badwater 135 brought to the table. Just to put on the race, Kossman had to wrangle permissions and assistance from 5 government agencies, including the National Forest Service, the National Park Service, and the California Highway Patrol. And he knew that if he allowed some greenhorn into the most difficult race ever conceived in the middle of summer, that motherfucker might die, and his race would vaporize overnight. No, if he was going to let me compete in Badwater, I was going to have to earn it. Because earning my way in would provide him at least some comfort that I probably wouldn't collapse into a steaming pile of roadkill somewhere between Death Valley and Mount Whitney. In his email, SBG attempted to make a case that because I was busy working as a SEAL, the prerequisites required to compete at Badwater, the completion of at least one 100-mile race or one 24-hour race while covering at least 100 miles, should be waived. If I was allowed in, SBG guaranteed him that I'd finish in the top 10. Kossman wasn't having any of it. He'd had accomplished athletes beg him to waive his standards over the years, including a champion marathoner and a champion sumo wrestler. Yeah, no shit. And he'd never budged. "One thing about me is I'm the same with everyone," Kossman said when I called him back. "We have certain standards for getting into our race, and that's the way it is. But hey, there's this 24-hour race in San Diego coming up this weekend," he continued, his voice dripping with sarcasm. Go run 100 miles and get back to me. Chris Kossman had made me. I was as unprepared as he suspected. The fact that I wanted to run Badwater was no lie, and I planned to train for it. But to even have a chance to do that, I'd have to run 100 miles at the drop of a damn hat. If I chose not to, after all that Navy SEAL bluster, what would that prove? That I was just another pretender ringing his bell way too early on a Wednesday morning, which is how and why I wound up running the San Diego one day with 3 days' notice. After surpassing the 50-mile mark, I could no longer keep up with Miss Inagaki, who bounded ahead like a damn rabbit. I soldiered on in a fugue state. Pain washed through me in waves. My thighs felt like they were loaded with lead. The heavier they got, the more twisted my stride became. I torqued my hips to keep my legs moving and fought gravity to lift my feet a mere millimeter from the earth. Ah, yes, my feet. My bones were becoming more brittle by the second, and my toes had banged the tips of my shoes for nearly 10 hours. Still, I fucking ran. Not fast, not with much style, but I kept going. My shins were the next domino to fall. Each subtle rotation of the ankle joint felt like shock therapy, like venom flowing through the marrow of my tibia. It brought back memories of my duct tape days from class 235, but I didn't bring any tape with me this time. Besides, if I stopped for even a few seconds, starting up again would be near impossible. A few miles later, my lungs seized and my chest rattled as I hocked up knots of brown mucus. It got cold. I became short of breath. Fog gathered around the halogen streetlights, ringing the lamps with electric rainbows, which lent the whole event an otherworldly feel. Or maybe it was just me in that other world, one in which pain was the mother tongue, a language synced to memory. With every lung-scraping cough, I flashed to my first buds class. I was back on the motherfucking log, staggering ahead, my lungs bleeding. I could feel and see it happening all over again. Was I asleep? Was I dreaming? I opened my eyes wide, pulled my ears, and slapped my face to wake up. I felt my lips and chin for fresh blood, and found a translucent slick of saliva, sweat, and mucus dribbling from my nose. SBG's hard-ass nerds were all around me now, running in circles, pointing, mocking the only black man in the mix. Or were they? I took another look. Everyone who passed me was focused, each in their own pain zone. They didn't even see me. I was losing touch with reality in small doses because my mind was folding over on itself, loading tremendous physical pain with dark emotional garbage it had dredged up from the depths of my soul. Translation, I was suffering on an unholy level reserved for dumb fucks who thought the laws of physics and physiology did not apply to them. Cocky bastards like me who felt like they could push the limits safely because they'd done a couple of hell weeks. Right, well, I hadn't done this. I hadn't run 100 miles with zero training. Had anybody in the history of mankind even attempted something so fucking foolish? Could this even be done at all? Iterations of that one simple question slid by like a digital ticker on my brain screen. Bloody thought bubbles floated from my skin and soul. Why? Why? Why the fuck are you still doing this to yourself? I hit the incline at mile 69, that 7-foot ramp, the pitch of a shallow driveway, which would make any seasoned trail runner laugh out loud. It buckled my knees and sent me reeling backward, like a delivery truck in neutral. I staggered, reached for the ground with the tips of my fingers, and nearly capsized. It took 10 seconds to cover the distance. Each one dragged out like an elastic thread, sending shockwaves of pain from my toes to the space behind my eyeballs. I hacked and coughed. My gut twisted. Collapse was imminent. Collapse is what the fuck I deserved. At the 70-mile mark, I couldn't take another step forward. Kate had set up our lawn chair on the grass near the start-finish line, and when I teetered toward her, I saw her in triplicate, 6 hands groping toward me, guiding me into that folding chair. I was dizzy and dehydrated, starved of potassium and sodium. Kate was a nurse. I had EMT training and went through my own mental checklist. I knew my blood pressure was probably dangerously low. She removed my shoes. My foot pain was no Sean Dobbs illusion. My white tube socks were caked in blood from cracked toenails and broken blisters. I asked Kate to grab some Motrin and anything she thought might be helpful from John Metz, and when she was gone, my body continued to decline. My stomach rumbled, and when I looked down, I saw bloody piss leak down my leg. I shit myself, too. Liquefied diarrhea rose in the space between my ass and a lawn chair that would never be quite the same again. Worse, I had to hide it, because I knew if Kate saw how bad off I really was, she would beg me to pull out of the race. I had run 70 miles in 12 hours with no training, and this was my reward. To my left, on the lawn, was another four-pack of Myoplex. Only a musclehead like me would choose that thick-ass protein drink as my hydrating agent of choice. Next to it was half a box of Ritz crackers, the other half now congealing and churning in my stomach and intestinal tract like an orange blob. I sat there with my head in my hands for 20 minutes. Runners shuffled, glided, or staggered past me as I felt time tick down on my hastily imagined, ill-conceived dream. Kate returned, knelt down, and helped me lace back up. She didn't know the extent of my breakdown and hadn't quit on me yet. That was something, at least. And in her hands were a welcome reprieve from more Myoplex and more Ritz crackers. She handed me Motrin, then some cookies and two peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, which I washed down with Gatorade. Then she helped me stand. The world wobbled on its axis. Again she split into two, then three, but she held me there as my world stabilized, and I took a single solitary step. Cue the ungodly pain. I didn't know it yet, but my feet were slivered with stress fractures. The toll of hubris is heavy on the ultra circuit, and my bill had come due. I took another step, and another. I winced. My eyes watered. Another step. She let go. I walked on. Slowly. Way too fucking slow. When I stopped at the 70-mile mark, I was well ahead of the pace I needed to run 100 miles in 24 hours. But now I was walking at a 20-minute-a-mile clip, which was as fast as I could possibly move. Miss Inagaki breezed by me and glanced over. There was pain in her eyes, too, but she still looked the part of an athlete. I was a motherfucking zombie, giving away all the precious time I stored up, watching my margin for error burn to ash. Why? Again the same boring question. Why? 4 hours later, at nearly 2 a.m., I hit the 81-mile mark, and Kate broke some news. "I don't believe you're going to make the time at this pace," she said, walking with me, encouraging me to drink more Myoplex. She didn't cushion the blow. She was matter-of-fact about it. I stared over at her, mucus and Myoplex dripping down my chin, all the life drained from my eyes. For 4 hours, each agonizing step had demanded maximum focus and effort, but it wasn't enough. And unless I could find more, my philanthropic dream was dead. I choked and coughed, took another sip. "Roger that," I said softly. I knew that she was right. My pace continued to slow and was only getting worse. That's when I finally realized that this fight wasn't about Operation Red Wings or the families of the fallen. It was to a point, but none of that would help me run 19 more miles before 10 a.m. No. This run, Badwater, my entire desire to push myself to the brink of destruction, was about me. It was about how much I was willing to suffer, how much more I could take, and how much I had to give. If I was going to make it, this shit would have to get personal. I stared down at my legs. I could still see a trail of dried piss and blood stuck to my inner thigh and thought to myself, who in this entire fucked up world would still be in this fight? Only you, Goggins. You haven't trained. You don't know dick about hydration and performance. All you know is you refuse to quit. Why? You know, let's pull back for a second, because I know your most avid fans and people who are listening or reading, a lot of them will have heard that story. You tell it on podcasts. It's so compelling, that story. It's more in detail here. But let's just go through it again. Like, where's your head? I mean, we know you need to find something more personal. Was that shocking for you, this thing that you thought was actually kind of a charitable race? Were you surprised that you were confronted this way?
I was very surprised. And I guess the biggest surprise to me was when I was duct taping my feet in that third hell week, I thought for sure there was nothing on the planet Earth that could even come near the kind of pain I was in during that third hell week or after that third hell week. This right here shocked the hell out of me because I had never been in a situation where I was so mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually, anything you can even think about, I was so messed up that even though we have a, you know, we did a good job of describing it here, unless I were to get my brain and put it in somebody's head, would they ever know the amount of suffering I was truly in?
Yeah, I mean, you've told me many times that there's nothing like this. Like, this still is the top level of suffering you've been through, right?
Nothing's even close to it. I'm 43, and I've done so much more.
Yeah, how many ultra races have you done?
I think I've done 60 of them.
Yeah, and this is still number one.
This is still number one, because when you go into something like this, and you are so undertrained and so underprepared, even mentally, you know, I had to reinvent the wheel mentally, because I really underestimated this race. Because, you know, I sat there and did the math, and it's like just shy of a 15-minute mile, and, you know, that's walking pace.
Mm-hmm.
But when you go out in a race like this, I went out running hard. I didn't go out walking. I didn't go out pacing myself. So when you go out and you're pretty much blown by mile 50, the next 50 miles become straight uphill.
Also, you might have been taking it a little lightly because you thought, shit, 130 hours is harder than 24 hours. If I can do 130 hours twice, I can do 24 hours once.
Exactly. But the thing that I didn't put into the whole equation was in Hell Week, sometimes you're in the water. Sometimes you're actually paddling, you know, like in your boat. Sometimes you're running. You're using different muscle groups. And what makes running so brutal is you're using the same exact muscle group for hours. And that's what killed me.
Interesting. I love how you put it here, and we're going to get into it now. How dreams like, how the goals we dream up for ourselves, the challenges that we imagine, they always come without the pain, right? You don't dream of the pain. You dream of the glory, not the pain.
Oh yeah. I always talk about that, man. We always, like, for instance, if you see something on TV that looks truly amazing, like maybe climbing Mount Everest, you're in a nice warm house. You're chilling out with, you know, your boyfriend, girlfriend, husband or wife. You know, you might be drinking, you know, a nice cool drink, and, you know, you're in a comfortable environment. So your mind makes you believe you can do anything. Oh my God, you know, I'm going to go climb Everest. But in that comfortable environment, your mind fools you completely. It's not until your ass is out there on Mount Everest and you're, you know, no oxygen, you're totally depleted, malnourished, do you start thinking, that was a dumbass idea on that couch. You know, that's when it comes real. It becomes real.
Perfect. Well, let's get back into it. We can talk a little bit more after the chapter. It's funny. Humans tend to hatch our most challenging goals and dreams, the ones that demand our greatest effort yet promise absolutely nothing, when we are tucked into our comfort zones. I was at work when Kosman laid out his challenge for me. I just had a warm shower. I was fed and watered. I was comfortable. And looking back, every single time I've been inspired to do something difficult, I was in a soft environment. Because it all sounds doable when you're chilling on your fucking couch with a glass of lemonade or a chocolate shake in your hand. When we're comfortable, we can't answer those simple questions that are bound to arise in the heat of battle because we don't even realize they're coming. But those answers are very important when you are no longer in your air-conditioned room or under your fluffy blanket, when your body is broken and beaten, when you're confronted with agonizing pain and staring into the unknown, your mind will spin, and that's when those questions become toxic. If you aren't prepared in advance, if you allow your mind to remain undisciplined in an environment of intense suffering, it won't feel like it, but it is very much a choice you are making. The only answer you are likely to find is the one that will make it stop as fast as possible. I don't know. Hell Week changed everything for me. It allowed me to have the mindset to sign up for that 24-hour race with less than a week's notice, because during Hell Week, you live all the emotions of life, all the highs and lows, in 6 days. In 130 hours, you earn decades of wisdom. That's why there was a schism between the twins after Marcus went through Buds. He'd gained the kind of self-knowledge that can only come from being broken down to nothing and finding more within. Morgan couldn't speak that language until he endured it for himself. After surviving 2 Hell Weeks and participating in 3, I was a native speaker. Hell Week was home. It was the fairest place I've ever been in this world. There were no timed evolutions, there was nothing graded, and there were no trophies. It was an all-out war of me against me, and that's exactly where I found myself again when I was reduced to my absolute lowest on a hospitality point. Why?